Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1042, interview number 11 with Jim DiGenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 26th of the year 2018. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiGenio, the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed, and also JFK, The Evidence Today. Jim, welcome back to our airwaves.
Okay, good evening, Dave.
I'd like to begin this discussion with clarifying a mistake that I made in our last talk. I was conflating what Jimmy Johnson, a Garrison investigator, termed the bomb with another document, another schematic that David Ferry had at his desk in C. Ray Gill's office. I wonder if you would first relate what the bomb was and then the document that Ferry had in Gill's office, filling in for us who C. Ray Gill was and what Ferry was doing there.
All right, very, very briefly. Jimmy Johnson was a undercover agent working for Jim Garrison. All right. And his assignment was to get close to Ferry. All right. And he told Garrison that Ferry used to talk about this file that he called the bomb. All right. And because he said it was literally, it would blow the lid off of New Orleans if it ever became public. So one day he was searching around in Ferry's apartment. And he found this file, all right? And he said it looked to him like it was some kind of an assassination plot, all right? It had a person, you know, with a wound, you know, in his right shoulder and his skull, all right? And it had a line going in one angle from 60 feet, okay? And 60 feet in the air. And then the other angle was much, much, much further. Okay. And it was like, it literally had to have been a plane. All right. And so, what he and, Garrison and both myself deducted was that this was probably, a plot against Castro. All right. Because there was a beach city, Veradero, that Castro used to drive out to, and it was relatively unguarded. It was kind of a resort area. And the CIA had actually thought of doing something on that road that led to Veradero. And so I think that that is what that particular diagram was about. Now, there's another case which happened at Ray Gill's office, where Ferry had a desk as an investigator, all right? Gill was one of the attorneys that worked for Carlos Marcello, all right? And what happened is that a woman named Clara Gay, her nickname was Bootsy, all right, had heard that Garrison had called in Ferry for questioning after the assassination. So she called up Gill's office, and she said it sounded like there was so much confusion and tumult going on in the background that she decided to walk over there, all right? And she noted a different map, okay? And this one was on Ferry's desk. This one, she tried, the secretary had thrown it into the trash, but she'd retrieved it from the trash, and she was looking at it, and it said, to, and she said to Garrison that this looked actually like a diagram of Dealey Plaza, because she recalled that it had written Elm Street, all right, on the map, you know, and it had that particular zigzag thing, all right, and so the secretary came over and tried to get it back from her. And they got into a tug of war, and since Bootsy was kind of older, the secretary won. But she did go ahead and tell Garrison about that experience. Now, I find these interesting because, as we know, at the trial and also at the preliminary hearing, Perry Russo talked about a meeting, gathering at Ferry's apartment, all right, in which the discussion seemed to go in that manner, that they were first talking about a plot against Castro, all right, and then they were talking about a plot against Kennedy. And both Shaw and Ferry were at that meeting along with Oswald, right? So this is what I mean about how, with the declassified files of the Assassinations Record and Review Board, a lot of this information has now gotten filled in which we only had, you know, like I would say, for example, if you wanted to compare it to a painting, you know, you only had the pencil outline of the easel, you know, before. But now, you know, with all these new documents, we're getting a lot more of the color, okay, you know, that the painter then puts on, lays on that pencil sketch. Now, let me also add this. We're never going to get the actual finished painting because, I don't know if I've talked about this yet, but so much of Garrison's files were lost, destroyed, and downright stolen, that we're never going to have everything that he had. I'd say that if we're lucky right now, we have about 40% of what Garrison actually did have in his files. But still, it's a definite improvement over what we had before the Assassinations Record Review Board.
Oh, amen. No question about it. Something that we should remind listeners of, Jim, because this has been and will continue to be a long series of programs, is that the CIA's activities against Castro not only involved Clay Shaw, as we spoke about in our last discussions, also David Ferry, of course, and Oswald, who was the Marxist Marine who was ostensibly a pro-Castro activist, actually appears to have been working the other side of the street and doing so as an infiltrator into the left and or Castro sympathizing milieu. So that is the context. And also, with Kennedy's working for a rapprochement, a diplomatic rapprochement with Castro, and in accordance with that, shutting down the camps with which Guy Bannister, David Ferry et al. Were involved, that would have quite literally placed JFK in the crosshairs of people like this. Now, Perry C. Ray Gill, of course, was Carlos Marcello's attorney. David Ferry, in addition to working with Bannister for CIA, also worked with Carlos Marcello. And Perry Russo, tell us a little bit about him, Jim, and again, some of the things that he witnessed at this get-together with Ferry, Shaw, and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes. The point you're making, Gill was one of the attorneys defending Marcello in court about Bobby Kennedy's attempts to get him thrown out of the country, all right? And so Marcello had a fleet of lawyers. Okay, he had, I'd say, from looking at that particular case, Marcello had about four lawyers. Gill happened to be the one in New Orleans, and Ferry was actually working on that particular case. All right, and then on the afternoon that it was over, the case was over, that's when he took his drive into Texas. All right, and then on his way back is when Garrison had him picked up. Now, to go back to the other point is Perry Russo was a insurance salesman who was a friend of Ferry's, right? And he, like Ferry, was of, let's call it, the right wing, very conservative persuasion. Having talked to Russo, I mean, I know that he was like that till the day he died, all right? Very conservative, very right wing, all right? And so he knew Ferry, all right? And he knew some of the teenagers, you know, the youths around him, around David Ferry, all right? And so during these gatherings at Ferry's apartment, all right, Russo was invited that night. He came with a girl, Sandra Moffat, all right, who I think left early, if I remember correctly. All right, and the gathering went on. There was Ferry, there was Shaw, there was Russo, there was Oswald, and about four or five Cubans. All right, and the discussion began with ways of knocking out Castro, because Kennedy was, as you mentioned earlier, Kennedy was cutting back drastically on Mongoose. You know, by this time, we're talking the summer of 63. You know, it had been drastically cut back because of the missile crisis, the deal that Kennedy had made with Khrushchev and Castro, all right, at the end of that crisis. All right, and so Kennedy was actually using things like the Coast Guard and the FBI to go ahead and bust some of these renegade camps, which we also talked about earlier, because people like Phillips were now trying to get funding from other sources, and this included Texas millionaires in the oil business, like the Hunt family, and also the mob. All right, they were also going to the mob.
Oh, by the way, Phillips was David Atlee Phillips, a.k.a. Maurice Bishop, whom we spoke about earlier, and who, in what was almost a deathbed confession to his estranged brother, admitted in through tears to being in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963.
Well, let's put it this way. He was in Dallas on the day Kennedy was assassinated.
Okay. In Dallas.
According to his conversation with his brother.
Yeah, not necessarily.
But anyway, as we talked about earlier, these CIA renegades, which I consider Phillips to be one of them, went ahead and tried to get alternative funding. You know, and they also brought in not just these millionaires from Texas, the mob guys, and plus the Minutemen. They were using them for arms, all right? And so Kennedy was busting them, you know, in order to keep his deal with the Russians and the Cubans. And so I don't have to tell you, I mean, anybody who understands what was going on back then, you know, the Cubans didn't like it. Right? They really didn't like it, all right? And so, you know, because now what was happening, of course, was because of the missile crisis, the whole idea of any kind of, you know, overthrow or even just plain harassment of the Castro regime was now, you know, going essentially drip, drip, drip down the drain. And so this is the background of this discussion that Russo talked about, you know, with Ferry, with Shaw, with Oswald. And remember, Oswald is the double agent, as you stated earlier, okay? And the Cuban exiles, right? So that's what made it so interesting, because that conversation, if you follow it, all right, that's what it goes from. It goes from Castro to Kennedy, all right? So it's a very interesting these pieces of evidence that we're talking about, okay, the bomb, okay, the drawing at Gill's office, all right, the backgrounds of Feary, Shaw, Oswald at this time period in 1963, it's all kind of blends together, you know, into a very kind of malignant, you know, and menacing kind of discussion. You know, and by the way, I should add, you know, in closing on this point, I'd be willing to wager there were a lot of these discussions going on in the late summer of 1963. Okay, because I don't know, did we talk about, because this wasn't the only plot to kill Kennedy. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Oh, absolutely, okay. Absolutely not.
Sure. Yeah.
No, I think you know, in listening to what you're saying, I think the term renegade might prove confusing to some, which, you know, they certainly were renegade with regard to official U.S. policy. But as we will be seeing down the road in a future interview, after we cover the assassination, the trial, what was done to Garrison, all of the infiltrators, actually infiltrators could be INFILTRAITRS, and the media shills that just did him in. We're going to talk about what, in effect, what destiny was betrayed, what Kennedy was trying to do. We spoke about that in our first couple of interviews, and then what happened afterward. But really, I think it for understanding, particularly for younger listeners, what we're really looking at here is the machinations, or are the machinations, of what was a coup d'etat. And so although they were renegade with regard to established White House U.S. policy, it brings to mind Dr. Johnson's very famous saying from centuries ago, it can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, for when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason.
And right.
That really is what we're looking at. Maybe I'm making too much of a semantic issue, but I think in terms of younger people understanding what it was that happened, and really, it's amazing. I was 14 when Kennedy was killed, and thinking back on those times and what he was doing and what the mainstream was at that time is just, you know, he would have been viewed as a card-carrying red. And
right.
That certainly would have made people see red, such as the people who were plotting and whom Perry Russo saw. In Destiny Betrayed, Jim, you talk about Perry Russo witnessing these discussions with Ferry, with Shaw, with Oswald present, and with a number of Cubans. And then some statements were made by Shaw and Ferry about Hammond, Louisiana, and the West Coast that made him realize this was more than just loose talk. I wonder if you would develop that for us.
Yeah, okay. Near the close of the discussion, all right, there was a kind of, I don't know if you would call it a cover, but they were saying that Shaw said that he should probably be on the West Coast when it happened, all right? And Ferry said that, you know, he should probably be up at some friend's house in Hammond, Louisiana, which he did know. He did know a lot of these young men, and this particular guy was at a dorm, all right, and a college at that in that area. And that's what happened, all right, on that fateful weekend. That's where these guys were. You know, Shaw was in San Francisco, and Ferry was coming back, and he stayed at this kid's dorm in Hammond. Now, in San Francisco, on that weekend, Shaw acted the... There was another trademark that he had made a reservation for months in advance, and he tried to say it really wasn't his idea, but it actually was his idea, all right, to be there. And so what happened is that the guy who met him at, I think, the airport, or it might have been a train station, but the guy who met him coming in, and they got the news that Kennedy had been assassinated. And this guy said it was really kind of strange, because to everybody, it hit them like, you know, a thunderclap, you know. But he said Shaw was strangely detached, and he said that when he suggested that they cancel the banquet, Shaw didn't want to do it. Shaw wanted to go through with it, you know, which is kind of weird when you think of, you know, I don't know what you were doing, but school let out the day that, you know, when it happened, okay, immediately. The secretary came on the intercom, and she made the announcement that President Kennedy had been assassinated in Dallas and that they were dismissing everyone to go home. That's what I remember.
Yeah,
you know.
I was on the East Coast. I was a freshman in high school, and there were rumors being passed around. I was in a study hall. Then my last class of the week on Friday afternoon was civics, oddly enough, on American history course. And the teacher announced that JFK had, in fact, been assassinated, and that he had been shot and died, and that school was dismissed, and so there would be no class. So, yeah, it was a stunning thing. I remember that Friday evening, the Dave Brubeck Quartet was scheduled to perform at the high school I was attending, and you know, obviously it was just a booking, but they canceled. A lot of events were basically surreptitiously yanked when the news came out.
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, as I remember it, you know, it was really a kind of enveloping event. You know, the school was dismissed. All right, some businesses closed down. My local newspaper, for the one and only time I ever remember, came out with an extra edition of the newspaper. I remembered it because I was a paper boy at the time. All right. And, you know, and I remember delivering those extra editions. And everybody was glued to their TV.
Yep. Yep.
You know? And so for Shaw to kind of display this rather, you know, unemotional and uninvolved reaction, you know, is kind of, you know, I don't mind saying it, is kind of odd, you know, that he would do that.
Yep.
You know, and so I think it's an important point to bring up.
Oh, a very, very important point. By the way, I used the word surreptitiously. I meant peremptorily. And, yeah, there was no business as usual. And in an earlier broadcast, we made reference to the concept of consciousness of guilt. And the fact, although not in and of itself definitive, the fact that Shaw was so detached and really was so focused on business as usual, quite literally, is indicative, although, again, not definitive. Point being that David Ferry was talking about, well, he would be in Hammond when it happened. Clay Shaw said he would be on the West Coast. And as you wrote, this basically clued Perry Russo into the fact that they weren't just, you know, drunken discussion that was taking place. They weren't just engaged in vituperation lubricated by alcohol, that this was an actual operation. And then they talked about where they were going to be, basically to give them cover. And Ferry was indeed in Hammond, Louisiana, at a South State campus. And Clayshaw, as you have indicated, was indeed on the West Coast in San Francisco and behaving rather curiously for someone who later, for PR purposes, was representing himself as an admirer of President Kennedy.
Right, right. That's an important point to bring up, because later on, after Garrison indicted him, that's what he said he was. He said he was a Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy liberal, and he admired President Kennedy.
He just couldn't seem to tear himself away from that business meeting in San Francisco.
Right, right. And as we're going to find out, you know, the idea that Shaw was a Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy liberal was not true either.
Oh, no. No, not even. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
One of the elements that looms large in the discussion of Garrison's investigation, and that is the aliases that were used by Clayshaw. He used the alias Clay Bertrand, also Clem Bertrand, and I wonder if you would develop some of that for us. In particular, Shaw's interactions with a guy named Dean Andrews, who was actually portrayed by John Candy, as I recall, in the movie JFK.
Right. All right. Now, this is an interesting point, okay, because Shaw used, I've been able to detect in my research, there was one called Clay Bertrand. There was one called Clem Bertrand, okay? Mm-hmm. And there was a third one called Alton Bernard, and that one he only used once. But the Clay Bertrand thing was pretty common, and it was used by him on numerous occasions. I think in my book, I spent two parts of the book dealing with this issue. In the early part of the book, and then the later part of the book. In the early part of the book, I basically did the things where he used that alias when it was known in 67 through 69. But then in the later part of the book, I brought in several declassified instances in which he used it. Now, the reason that this figured into Garrison's investigation, and by the way, I should say it wasn't just Garrison's investigation, because Mark Lane interviewed Dean Andrews even before Garrison got to him, all right? And so Garrison was looking through one of his copies of the Warren Commission volumes. And one thing that very much interested him and interested a lot of people was a testimony of this lawyer in New Orleans named Dean Andrews, all right? And the reason it's important is because he said that on, I think, the 23rd, someone called him and to tell him to go to Dallas to defend Oswald, all right? And he said his name was Clay Bertrand, all right? Now, the FBI and Warren Commission zealots did everything they could to try and discredit this testimony, all right? I mean, really, they did everything, all right? You know, including, you know, threatening Andrew's life, all right? But it was in the Warren Commission. You couldn't really take it back, all right? And so they just didn't want him to go any further with it. And so he didn't, you know? And so then the riddle became, well, who was this guy? You know, and Andrews wouldn't tell anybody, except, as we'll find out, one person He did tell one person.
We might want to mention before we go on that Andrews, aside from being manipulated, and we'll get to Walter Sharon in a future discussion, but Andrews expressed fear for his life in connection with this. It wasn't like he just, well, you know, it's not important. He was afraid for his person if he went further with the discussion. And as we will see, with good reason. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Well, what happened is that Garrison, since Andrews would not cooperate with him, all right, and tell him who this guy was, you know, Garrison began to go ahead and send out his assistants to find out who he was, all right? And they came to the conclusion, through several witnesses, that Bertrand was Clay Shaw. There was a woman at the VIP room of, I think it was American Airlines in New Orleans Airport, that testified, you know, that he signed his register, you know, in that name. There was Aloysius Habekhorst, who was the booking fingerprint guy at the downtown police department. And he said that when he asked this guy, have you ever used an alias, Shaw said Bertrand. All right. And there were other places, like, for example, a common bar in New Orleans, in which both Andrews and Shaw frequented. The bartender said that Shaw, but the point is, today, in my book, oh my God, I must have at least 13 witnesses that have now been declassified as recognizing Shaw as Bertrand. And this includes Andrews, because of a very good British researcher, Martin Hay, went through the archives at Harold Weisberg's collection at Hood College, and there's an unpublished book in which Harold revealed that he struck up an acquaintance with Dean Andrews while he was working in New Orleans for Garrison. And he asked him, between me and you, and I won't tell anybody if you don't want me to, you know, was Shaw Bertrand? And Andrews told him that he was. He goes, but I don't want you to tell anybody. All right? And so that's why Weisberg went ahead and didn't reveal it. Not even after Andrews died, he didn't reveal it. All right? And so that's pretty much. And by the way, to show you how bad this got, the FBI knew that Shaw was Bertrand. Right? I mean, that's in my book also. But not just that. You know, in a later declassified memo, all right, it was revealed that Carter DeLoach, who was the number three guy at the FBI at that time, said that in the wake of the assassination, you know, we had some information concerning Clay Shaw. All right? He didn't specify what it was. And this was in December of 1963. You know, and then later it was also declassified that the FBI had several sources who revealed to them that Shaw used that alias at times. So it's not, I think there were at least five FBI sources in addition to all the ones from Garrison. Yeah. So this is how bad this case got. The FBI knew that Garrison was correct, but they wouldn't say so. That's how bad this case got for Garrison.
Things were bad indeed. I'd like to underscore a point, which is that when Shaw was booked for the assassination of JFK, and a New Orleans police officer with an excellent record, as you point out, named Aloysius, A-L-O-Y-S-I-U-S, Habighorst, H-A-B-I-G-H-O-R-S-T, was the booking officer, and he was told by Shaw that he used the alias Clay Bertrand. And so that when Shaw was booked, he told the booking officer that that was an alias that he used. That is so fundamental in terms of legal and politically scientific analysis. Also, looking ahead briefly, Jim, I mentioned that Dean Andrews feared for his life. When we get to the trial, you mentioned that a number of people who had information to contribute had some interesting things happen to them, and one of those was Aloysius Habekors. If you would briefly talk about what happened to him.
I talked to Habekors' wife, all right, back in the 90s, and she told me that Garrison had protection on Habekors going up to the trial, you know, because of what had happened to some of his other witnesses, all right? And for some reason, he took it off the night before that he was going to testify, all right? And that night, a pickup truck pulled out of an alleyway and sideswiped him. In other words, he had to dodge and get out of the way. All right, and because I wondered, you know, why was this guy wearing these sunglasses going in the court? And she said that's why, because when he tried to get away from the truck, you know, he fell on his face and he had a black eye. All right, so that's why he had those sunglasses on. All right, so that's one example of the unbelievable harassment that Garrison's office and his witnesses came under at this time period.
Again, people have attacked Garrison because of the use of the aliases by Clay Shaw, and yet when he was booked, he gave the alias Clay Bertrand. And
right.
The booking officer, again, Habekors, had an excellent NOPB record. And then shortly before he was to testify, his truck was rammed.
And by the way, I guess we should add here, the judge wouldn't let him testify.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we get to the trial. But Judge Hagerty,
right.
in an earlier discussion, I read a paragraph where Garrison... Haggerty was at a meeting with a Marcello associate named Giordano, and they were discussing, well, how come when Jim Garrison takes away our pinball machines, he doesn't give them back to us the way they did
right.
before? And although certainly not in and of itself definitive, the fact that Judge Hagerty was present in this rarefied social environment is certainly interesting. And as we see what happened with the trial, that looms larger. And again, Shaw was booked. The booking officer stated that, yeah, Clay Shaw, well, you know, in the recorded statements, stated that Clay Shaw was Clay Bertrand, and yet Judge Hagerty would not permit that to be entered into evidence.
Right.
Which, you know, for younger listeners, when someone is booked for a crime and when they are asked by an officer, do you use any aliases, and they then say, yeah, that is pretty bedrock in terms of legal documentation. But when we examine what happened, it's why I emphasized the point I made earlier about the use of the term renegade. What we're really looking at here is not only a coup d'etat, but I would submit a fascist machination, in that we have the legal machinery, the media, which we'll come to. I think there is no more important part of your very important book than the way the media behaved and the national security establishment and the corporations all acting as part of a fascus, a bundle of sticks with a leather, bound with a leather thong and an axe head, the symbol of the Roman Republic and also the root icon of the term fascism. They are bound together and everything else becomes perverted or completely negated in the service of this Faskus and Judge in the microcosm, Judge Haggerty, and his treatment of Officer Habeckhorst and what he had to contribute, I think really underscores that and develops that in a hard way.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
We've been talking about Clay Shaw and his interactions with David Ferry in Clinton, Louisiana, their discussion of triangulation of fire in front of Perry Russo. He then discovered that that was not just a hypothetical discussion. When Ferry mentioned that he was going to go to ground in Hammond, Louisiana, and Shaw on the West Coast, and they did just that. Talking about Clay Shaw. He had a very interesting background. And before we get further into the JFK assassination per se, Jim, I'd like to talk about Clay Shaw's background, going all the way back to the Second World War and his work as an aide-de-camp for General Thrasher. Develop that for us, if you would.
Yes. This is, I believe, you know, one of the most important parts of the book. Right, and it's something that I decided to concentrate on rather early in my research career, because I just felt that everybody was investigating Garrison, nobody's investigating Shaw. What a reversal, you know?
Well, absolutely. That's why I made the comment about the Faskus. Maybe that was a bit overly long or perhaps unnecessary, but exactly right. You know, they're investigating Garrison and hitting him with every conceivable form of discreditation, and yet Clay Shaw remains, you know, the persecuted gay in the minds of
Garrison, when he was working with the House Select Committee, he nicknamed Shaw in his memoranda Mr. Clean. Okay, you know.
Yeah.
So what I did is I decided, you know something, I think I'm going to be the first person to actually really write up an inquiry of this guy. And thank God I wasn't the last, because other people like Joan Mellon and Bill Davey followed me. But back then in the 90s, when I was seriously getting into this, I decided, you know, I think this guy's a much more interesting character, mysterious character, than the media made him out to be. And so that's when I found out. And so, as you mentioned, going back to his years in the service, there is evidence that Shaw was the aide-de-camp to General Charles Thrasher, which is interesting because Thrasher was a part of one... I don't know if you ever talked on the air about that book by James Baku, Other Losses. Have you ever heard that book?
No, I have not.
Okay. That was the first expose of the brutality that the Americans exhibited to the Germans prisoner of war after the war. All right? And it was really a very bad, brutal scandal. All right? In which there's no doubt that, as James Baku wrote in his book out of Canada called Other Losses in its first edition, that there was a lot of things that should not have been done and a lot of people that should have gone on trial, rather court-martial, for what they did. And there was no doubt a cover-up about it. All right, and Shaw was the aide-de-camp to Thrasher. So that means that it's hard to believe that Shaw was not in on this, and since that part of what they were doing related to an intelligence operation, then Shaw had to have some connection to that, you know? And so that was step one, all right? Then going through Garrison's files, I began to put together how Shaw was a, when he opened up the International Trademark, that he was working on these intelligence contacts with both the FBI and the CIA after he came back from the service with a Mississippi Steamship Company. Because, see, you understand, New Orleans was really the gateway into Central America and South America. You know, and when the FBI and the CIA both had strong interests, you know, in that area at the time. You know, and then the FBI, of course, when these delegations would come in into New Orleans, they would want some information on them. And one of Shaw's earliest functions was that he would do this kind of stuff, all right, for them, for both the FBI and the CIA, all right? Now, let me also add that the International Trademark was a kind of sister organization to something called International House, which was also in New Orleans. Now, if you go ahead and examine the background of International House, International House, there were literally dozens of them throughout the world. And this began as a kind of, it was a Rockefeller, early Rockefeller venture, all right, in which they would try and spread this whole gospel of one worldism. They would bring in these students from foreign countries, you know, and they would put them up at these at the International House, and then they would have speakers there, you know, most of them on international issues, okay? And it was their way of introducing this concept. And if you think about it, of course, you know, that's what the International Trademark was about. The International Trademark was about free trade. You know, and I, as I wrote in my book, you know, this we all know what free trade has done to this country. It's pretty much decimated our economy.
A synonym for that term is globalization.
Right, right. Right. And so, as I also wrote in my book, see, Kennedy was a nationalist, all right? He was against that doctrine, you know? And as, if you want to read a good book on that, just take a look at Donald Gibson's fine book, Battling Wall Street, you know? And this is how he came in opposition to David Rockefeller specifically on this issue, right? And so this is another thing that began to go ahead and mushroom into Clay Shaw's importance as both an overt asset of the establishment and as a covert asset. And we Shaw's intelligence career is very hard to put together because, as Bill Davey discovered back in the 90s, the CIA had done some skullduggery with Shaw's record. They eliminated something called a Y file, okay, that was in his record. But the importance of Shaw and the reason that you can't consider him as part, which is what the CIA tried to do, as some kind of part of their businessman's contacts, you know, that's a program where the CIA would interview thousands of people coming back from foreign countries who had business arrangements there. Well, the thing is, Shaw was briefed before he left. That's how important Shaw was to the CIA. In other words, they were giving him assignments, and it wasn't meeting with just low-level business leaders. Shaw was interviewing some very important people in very important positions in governments south of the border, you know, and that's why he was briefed in advance and then would go ahead and be debriefed on what he found out about them when he came back. Now, in addition to that, there was also a very important document that just came out of the files, I think about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. It was originally declassified in 93. But it said that Shaw was a valued and well-paid contract agent of the Central Intelligence Agency beginning in the 1950s. All right? That, now, that is a very, very important document, okay, because the CIA has always tried to deny this was the case. And if you couple that with the document saying that he had a covert security approval for a project called QK Enchant, you know, those kinds of things just go ahead and decimate the cover story about Shaw. And one last thing that didn't make it into my book, because I didn't discover it until years later, is that when the ARB was going through Shaw's files, all right, the guy who was examining them, the lawyer who was examining them and in liaison with the CIA, wrote a memo to Jeremy Gunn, who was the chief counsel of the ARB, saying that the CIA has destroyed Shaw's 201 file. Now, if you ever needed a smoking gun, you know, that's it. And he deduced this by looking through the records showing that, look, there's stuff that's supposed to be in here that's not in here. Okay? And let me add one more thing about that. Many years ago, when I was in contact with a guy I know you're aware of, a guy named Gordon Novell.
Yeah, all right. I've made his acquaintance via a telephone call at 2:40
a.m. I've heard it, Dave.
I know. And listeners have heard it, the veteran listeners. I was a guest on an AOR talk show in the wee hours of Monday morning, and about the show ended at 3 p.m., about 20, or 3 a.m., rather, at 20 to 3, Gordon Novell called. And, people can hear what he had to say and what I had to say. Yeah, about Gordon Novell and Clay Shaw. Go ahead.
Well, he wrote a letter to a prominent researcher, which I got a hold of, in which he told her that the CIA in 1964, issued an order to the Office of Security, a guy named Howard Osborne, you know, that they were going to conceal Clay Shaw's true agency status, you know, from any future investigation, including the Warren Commission, into the Kennedy case. And he specifically talked about Garrison. He specifically talked about the House Select Committee. Now, in this particular instance, you know, I've never been one to say that we should take anecdotal evidence, as the goddamn truth. But what he said back then, I think it was in 1976, corresponds with what we've discovered later on through the declassified files, you know, that it's pretty clear now that the CIA was concealing their relationship with Clay Shaw from the Warren Commission, from Jim Garrison, and from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. So as far as that goes, he was correct.
Absolutely. And by the way, in our next interview, I'm going to begin by reading a section of your book about the information that has come to light, and with the given that a lot of the pertinent information about Shaw was eliminated or suppressed, what has come to light is more than a little interesting, and I think perhaps even more revealing in that context. Very quickly, Jim, you mentioned that Clay Shaw's intelligence involvement goes all the way back to World War II, his work for Thrasher and with the SOS, a military intelligence function. And then he begins working for International House, a Rockefeller project, does work for Mississippi Shipping Company and a firm that had CIA links. And bearing in mind that New Orleans was not only the northernmost port of the Caribbean, but the gateway to the largest commercial waterway in the U.S., the Mississippi River, a very important strategic location. And then International Trade March, from which Lee Harvey Oswald booked his passage to Europe to begin his, quote, defection, unquote, to the Soviet Union. We not only see a progression of intelligence functions, but in Shaw's work for Freeport Sulphur that we spoke about, we see him working in connection with the highest echelons of the Eastern, or really the corporate power elite, Godfrey Rockefeller, John Hay Whitney, in connection with Freeport Sulphur, and David Rockefeller in connection with I-House and International Trade March. So it is not as though Clay Shaw were some minor figure and dabbler in the clandestine art. He was someone who was working in conjunction with and perhaps at the behest of the dominant power interests in our country. And as we get into what more of his intelligence functions, bearing in mind that so much has, in fact, been suppressed. The QK enchant designation is something I'd like to read and have you develop still further for us in our next interview.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Jim, we have a little less than 5 minutes left. I'd like you to tell us about JFK, the evidence today, and also Kennedy's and King and Black Op Radio.
All right. At my website, which is called KennedysandKing.com, you can read various articles, reviews, book reviews, film reviews, research articles on all the major assassinations of the 1960s. You can also go ahead and click through to purchase either one of my most recent books, which are the book we're under discussion, Destiny Betrayed, all right, the second edition, or my more recent book, which is called The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, all right? And that's more of a kind of micro-analysis of the case, whereas Destiny Betrayed is more of a macro-analysis, more of a big-picture thing, all right? Now, also, I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's radio show called Black Op Radio, which is on every Thursday night and out of Vancouver. So if you want to get in contact with me or listen to me, those are the ways you do it.
And, of course, our previous 10 interviews are already archived with Spitfire List, as will these others. And people can arrange to have For the Record podcast for them. There is a link to WFMU in the New York area that is doing just that. So if you like the newer technology and would like to have the program podcast for you, that is how you can have it done. And again, Kennedy's and King, the website that Jim presides over, and JFK, the Evidence Today, and Destiny Betrayed can be ordered from there. You can hear Jim Moore on Black Op Radio. I'd like to, in my next talk, Jim, recap some of the points of information we've made by way of further developing who Clay Shaw was, and really setting the context for his conspiratorial discussion with David Ferry, where they're talking about triangulation of fire, although Ferry was the more voluble of the participants. Clay Shaw was there, and when we see who he was and the circles in which he moved, That will, I think, lend a greater understanding and gravitas to the analysis that we have been able to develop so far. So that is how I'd like to begin our next interview. This concludes For the Record program number 1042, interview number 11 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 26th of the year 2018. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.